Good morning, council. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. We have one case set for oral argument this session, State v. Cerna, cause number 03-20-00087-CR. You all probably are well aware that COVID has changed the rules for the court and nearly everything else in our country. And speakers, including justices and attorneys, and actually, that's all we have in the courtroom, so I'll limit this, my opening remarks, but basically, y'all are exempt from masks. If there were anybody in the courtroom, they would be wearing masks, but it's just you and us justices here. Basically, a clerk will sanitize the podium and microphone after each speaker. So after the first speaker, please wait to approach the podium until after the clerk sanitizes the podium area. This session will be live streamed on the court's YouTube channel. An audio recording of the argument will be available later on the court's website. Each side is allocated 20 minutes, and I think the announcements have already, the clerk's already stated that there will be 15, 20, and 5 in your time allotments. We have a time warning system to help the lawyers know when they've argued to the end of their time. When the yellow light comes on, you'll have 2 minutes left to wrap up that segment of your argument. When the red light comes on, time is up. You can finish whatever thought you're in, but it should not start a new point unless you request permission from the court to do so. I'd like to ask you all for announcements for the oral argument this morning. And you're ready?
And Susan Shaw for appellee John Cerna, ready.
Thank you. Okay. And just one housekeeping, which kind of doesn't really mean much here because we don't have an audience, but if you all have cell phones that haven't been silenced, you might think about doing so before you start. Other than that, I'll go ahead and ask counsel for state to begin.
May it please the court, counsel. Before the court today is a criminal case. It is a case where the defendant, Johnny Joe Cerna, was indicted for the felony offense of felon in possession of a firearm. He's alleged to be a habitual felon based on 3 prior felony convictions in addition to the felony that makes him a felon. This all arises from the fact that while on parole, he committed another felony offense for which a warrant was issued by Detective Mark Christian, or he sought and got issued by court. He then sought help in serving that warrant because of the defendant's status as a member of the Texas Mexican Mafia. So he contacted Officer Muchigambo with the Sheriff's Department as well as Hector Parra, which is his partner, to assist in serving this warrant because of his gang status. The address where they believed he might be at was 228 Peach Street, New Braunfels, Comal County, Texas. They had checked some records, found that was a potential address. They checked with his parole officer to confirm he had provided that as an address. Based on that information, on October 17th of 2018, they went out to that address to look for him. They circled around, pulled a couple of houses down. They saw a car in the driveway area right up near the house. They could see that there was exhaust coming out of it. They got out and started to walk up that area. They saw a male. It looked like he was in the vehicle. That male started leaning over what they described typically police officers' furtive movements, like he was messing around with something around the seat area. As they got closer, Officer Muchigamba recognized him as the defendant, Johnny Joe Cerna. They made contact with him. He got out of the car, locked the door pretty quickly. He had a little dog. He started telling him he needed to put the dog inside the house. They kept telling him, you can stick it right inside the door, come here. They obviously were concerned about him getting into this residence. Regardless of that, he went in. They followed him into the house, back through the house. It's very cluttered from the video. There's body cam. You can see the entire thing. the bedroom area. He's rummaging around. They're trying to tell him, hey, we need you outside. We need you outside. They eventually get him outside. He stands by that car. He's handcuffed, standing by the vehicle right there. They walk down the driveway. There's a couple of cars. They get down to the street area right there at the end of the driveway where he leans on one of the cars for a considerable amount of time.
Counselor, can I interrupt real quick? At this point, has any of the officers seen the gun in plain sight yet?
Yes.
When did that occur?
When they were there by the car, when they was being handcuffed.
So when he's being handcuffed, that's when?
And actually, counsel, in her brief on page 8, it's noted, while lawfully in place under the authority of the arrest warrant, the officer looked in the car window and saw the firearm partially under the seat of the car. And it's noted there right below that that the appellee agreed on the record with that assertion. So that wasn't really disputed.
But Mr. McCrary, didn't Judge Waldrop specifically hold in his findings of fact that the gun was not seen until officers went back under the carport?
He found that the officer wasn't credible. I think his statement based on video evidence, which I'm not sure what that meant exactly, Justice Kelly, the way it's phrased is a little bit odd. It doesn't make a specific finding as to when he saw the gun. It's what I said. It's phrased in an odd manner.
So what I see from his order, the video and best evidence indicates that one of the officers then walked back to the passenger side, so after they've left the driveway, the vehicle previously occupied by Cerna just minutes prior. Upon looking through the passenger window, the officer returned to the street and indicated he was able to see the handgun partially in plain view under the passenger seat. So for us as the appellate court, and you're not contesting any of Judge Waldrop's factual findings, we have to assume that this factual finding is correct in our analysis, right?
I'm not sure that is the case, considering that the opposing side conceded otherwise.
But in your brief, you say we do not contest any of the findings of fact of the judge. You don't say we contest the findings of fact, and by the way, you know, the appellee's counsel in this case agreed to that on the record. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. If we assume that the house is Cerna's home, as Judge Waldrop seems to hold in his order, doesn't Cerna necessarily have a privacy interest in the curtilage of that home?
No.
Okay, so if not, then what's your best case for why not?
There's a couple of reasons why he doesn't have, and that's an interesting thing, because appellee's counsel over here in her brief goes into a great deal of effort pointing out the reasons to believe this is Cerna's home, and quite frankly, whether it's his home or not, let's just say he was the homeowner, that might even be irrelevant in this particular fact scenario. There's a couple of reasons in this particular case why that's the case. First of all, he's a guest. Obviously, it's not his home, and I can cite to you a number of places on the video where the homeowner actually arrives and identifies this as her home. She very specifically says that he and her daughter are only allowed to use one bedroom in the home. And so there is a number of cases I've cited in the state's brief where just because you're a resident or a guest in a home, it doesn't give you an expectation of privacy as to the entire residence. For example, there are a number of areas. There's one case where they talk about a trap in a house. There's another case where there's an attic where a guest would not have an expectation of privacy. There's a case where there's a garage, interestingly enough, where there was some garbage cans, where the court specifically found that a guest doesn't have an expectation of privacy. There's the Meredith case from El Paso, which I cited fairly extensively.
But the Meredith case, weren't those items seized from the defendant's person? In the Meredith case?
I think one of the items was. I don't think all of them were in that particular fact scenario.
What would be your response to then Judge Waldrop and his findings of fact and conclusions of law on pages 3, 4, and 5? He calls the house Cerna's residence. And then on page 2 calls it he calls it the residence where he stayed, but then he specifically calls it his residence two other times.
To the degree that if you're saying that he made a fact finding that that's actually physically his legit home, like he owns the home, I would say in that case that there is indisputable video evidence that would show that finding's incorrect, and it's still subject to de novo review because the defendant himself very specifically says it's not his house on video. He says it's his mother-in-law's home, and that's on video. And the mother-in-law arrives and specifically says it's her home, and what I said about him only being allowed to use one room. So if there is a finding contrary to that, it's clearly not accurate.
But if we assume that that was his residence, like take that out of the picture, if we assume that that's his residence and he has a legitimate privacy interest in the residence, then doesn't he have a privacy, then under that scenario, would he have, in your view, a privacy interest in the curtilage?
In the curtilage? Yes, that doesn't end the analysis, though, as to standing to the particular area, because as I point out in the state's brief, even if we were talking about the homeowner, the case law is pretty clear that a police officer, like any other citizen, can approach a house, knock on the door, and make contact with the occupants. Counsel in this case notes that, I believe the way she phrases, there's no evidence that the public used that door, but all the evidence in this case is that is the door being used. The defendant used it, the homeowner used it, everybody used it, and what's most notable and I think is key in this case is when you watch the video, the homeowner, when she is leaving, as she leaves the officers there, she very specifically gestures to that door and indicates that's the door they should use, making it clear that that is a door commonly used. So those officers, whether we're talking about the owner, guest, or otherwise, could walk up to that door, even though it's in the curtilage. So I think that's an important fact.
Counsel, talk about what the limits of the arrest warrant, what the arrest warrant allowed the officers to do or not to do.
It basically allowed them to go onto the property, which is the issue. And that's what makes this case quite complex. I mean, factually, it's very simple. There's like 30 minutes of video that's key to the case. It's more like a law school quiz because you have all these different pieces and places. And so there's the house. Expectation of privacy in the house are not, probably not really relevant because we don't seize anything out of the house. Ultimately, there's a lot of discussion about whether he has expectations in the house and whether he's evidence because he tries to exclude them, telling them, yeah, I think he asked at one point, do you have a warrant? Probably not really important to what we're talking about. There's also expectation and standing as to the car. But the key to this case is not any of those things. It's that little piece of concrete from the street up to right there outside the door that goes by that car. That's what we're talking about. And so that's where you have to focus in on this case and whether the officers could lawfully go into that area. And there's a lot of things. The arrest warrant allows them to go, obviously, into the house to arrest him. It allows them to go onto the curtilage. In fact, I cite a case where they talk about if you can go in the house, you can go around the back and look in the windows. There's case law to that effect. So obviously being on the property in of itself, they're allowed to do that.
Mr. McCrary, once they take Mr. Serna and they take him, you know, out to the street and they handcuff him, what right then do the officers have to re-enter the curtilage?
There's a question, I believe, Justice Kelly, as to whether they ever left the curtilage.
Okay.
That's an interesting question, too, because it depends on where you draw that line as to what you're going to consider curtilage in this case, because they're right there at the back of that car on that driveway the whole time. Some of the officers are milling around. I don't know if this is going to be called, like, whether it was a touchdown in a football game, whether someone crossed the plane at the end of that driveway, or how close we're going to call that line. But they are right there at the property the entire time. They don't go away. They're right there. And, in fact, they're there because the defendant asked them to stay. Also an interesting fact. Because he is very adamant that they stay until the mother-in-law can get there to lock the house, which is also interesting in the sense that one of the aspects of standing is whether you have a right to exclude others, and it's fairly obvious he doesn't have the ability or right to exclude anybody from this property. He doesn't even have a key to it. He's not trusted to lock people out of the house. He has to wait on his mother-in-law to show up, the homeowner. So I would question whether they ever left the curtilage, but there's also case law that I reviewed in preparing for this where when an officer actually was in a house, say based on exigent circumstances, and observed contraband and then walked out to the car on the street and got gloves and went back in and collected it. Obviously, they were allowed in the house the first time, but then there's questions about the going back in the house to collect the evidence.
But you're not arguing exigent circumstances
in this case. No, I'm not. I'm just pointing out that there's case law. What the courts have said is basically walking back where you've just been isn't really a separate incident or a separate search, I believe is the way they've analyzed
that. Okay, so your view is if there's still a foot in the driveway by one of the officers, they can go back and forth in that driveway as many times as they want.
I think Fourth Amendment law is all based on reasonableness, and I think in this case what they did was reasonable ultimately. I think when you're looking at the totality of the circumstances, what's going on out here, the fact that there is a warrant, this isn't like the Collins case where they had absolutely no reason to be on the property. There's not a tarped piece of property past where the door to the house is. There's a lot of distinctions to be made in this case. One that we haven't talked about is the fact that he is a parolee. And
okay.
I think that is a very important point that goes to his standing. And I'm going to cite a case I didn't include in my brief. For what it's worth, it's out of a district court in Pennsylvania, but it's United States versus Vinson. Citation is 2009, Texas District Lexus 465-55. And that's a case very similar where the guy was a guest in a girlfriend's house, and there's a debate about what his standing is in that. And we're talking about inside the actual house in this case. And the court goes through and they cite a Taylor case out of the Fifth Circuit extensively. And the fact that you're a parolee means that you have a diminished expectation of privacy in anywhere you're at, including your own home.
And okay. So walk us through why the arrest warrant in this case would allow the seizure of the handgun.
So,
because mustn't there be some evidence, which we don't have in the record, that handguns are always related to credit debit card abuse?
I don't believe that's a problem in this case because, as duly noted in the record, without any dispute whatsoever, and in fact in the judge's findings, he was a parolee. And
okay.
As a parolee, he's a convicted felon. That's pretty
okay.
obvious. In fact, it's noted that he has multiple felonies, so the firearm is clearly evidence, felon in possession of a firearm.
So then is it your view that in any case that involves somebody who's a convicted felon, whether or not they're on parole, that officers are always entitled to search for a weapon?
It's not a matter of searching so much as seizing the weapon when they do observe it in a place they're lawfully allowed to be. I do believe when they see the weapon, we're in a place where they're lawfully allowed to be, they're allowed to seize that weapon. And so that's what the question is in this case. They go on the property, they're on the property lawfully with an arrest warrant. At some point they see the weapon. I know there may be some dispute as to when that occurs, but they know immediately, and the counsel doesn't dispute, they have probable cause based on this fact scenario at that point. That is clearly contraband. So the only question then, and where I think counsel is making the argument, is that they can't seize that they still have to get a warrant. And there's a lot of talk about the mobility of the car and all of that. Clearly the automobile exception, mobility means that it's operational. This guy just operated it. It meets the mobility definition.
Counsel, your time's up.
Sorry.
May it please the court. Good morning. I guess I would like to start with whether or not Collins even applies to this case. I think the state needs you to believe that it doesn't in order for their argument to advance at all. And I do want to correct some things in the record that Mr. McCrary spoke about during his time. First of all, it's clear in the video that when the officers arrive in the neighborhood, because they're parked like a block away, when they walk up to the house, you can clearly see on video that there is a front door and a front porch. Then the driveway goes along the grass, past the perimeter of the house where this vehicle at issue is parked. It's a one-car, single-car narrow driveway with two other cars parked behind it. Mr. Serna explained to the officers that he was moving the car up so his father-in-law could pass because he's handicapped or something. But to say that these officers had license to go where any other citizen could go is absolutely not accurate in this case. Every person you see on that video that is entering or exiting the door within the carport is family. It's true that the mother-in-law of Mr. Serna explained to the officers that she had to leave. If they needed something, talk to her daughter who was in the house. She motions to that door. But that is not what a regular citizen, salesman, whoever is able to approach the front door is able to do. That is beyond the scope of what that license allows someone to do. A citizen wouldn't walk up and start breaking into a car based on that license. They knock, wait. If they're not admitted, then they have to leave. And so that clearly is not applicable in this case.
Ms. Schoen, let's go to Mr. McCrary's point about the curtilage. Doesn't your position depend on the finding or conclusion that the officers have left the curtilage before returning back to the car? Is that...
Yes, I believe so. Yes, because I agree, and it gets confusing when he starts talking about what I agree with and what I don't. We can see that the arrest warrant itself allows the officers a limited ability to go into someone's property if they believe that person is there and to arrest that person. That's all that does. Now, let's say, like in this case, let's say that he did observe the weapon in plain view while they were standing there handcuffing Mr. Serna by the back door.
Do you agree with that? He said that you concede that point.
I think I conceded that if he did, that was lawful for him to see in plain view.
Okay.
I'm not sure I conceded he saw it, but correct me if I'm wrong. I believe I said if he saw it, then I have no problem with that. It's in plain view. So I think that Judge Waldrop's finding was that it didn't appear on video, but the officer testified that he had seen it at that point. He was certainly next to the vehicle. So if he did, then that's okay. He was legally in place to see that. The problem that I had from that point, though, is what gives him the right to access, to seize that gun. And I believe the state relies on the automobile exception for that. And to answer your question, Justice Kelly, I do argue they took Mr. Serna out all the way to the street, which is a much longer distance than Mr. McCrary would have you believe. They go past two cars all the way to the street. So they're not anywhere near the carport when he's out there. At that point, one of the officers goes back, apparently looks in the car, comes back and tells the other officer, "I saw a gun in the car." He, at some point, then asked Mr. Serna for consent to search. He says, "Absolutely not." He says, "That's my wife's car. I don't want any trouble. I'm cooperating with you." "No." And they get into an exchange, and the officer says, "I'm getting in that car. You know, whether you give me the keys or whether I bust out the window, I'm getting in that car." Our position at that point, he is reentering the curtilage for the sole purpose of seizing a weapon in that car. And the automobile exception cannot give him that authority under these circumstances. And so, does Collins apply? Absolutely it does. You can look at the description of what they deemed curtilage, comparing it to what we have here, it's almost identical. The only thing that we're not clear about is that whether there were short walls on all sides, or if we only had the house as constituting an enclosure to that carport. But it was definitely an enclosure the same way it was in Collins. They even said in Collins a person would have to walk up the driveway toward the carport, but at some point they would have to veer off the driveway and head to the front door. That is exactly the situation that we have here. And so I think Collins does apply. Some of their language, I think the state cannot get past if it does apply. Like, the question before the court is whether the automobile exception justifies the invasion of the cartilage. The answer is no. And at the end, they say, for the foregoing reasons, we conclude that the automobile exception does not permit an officer without a warrant to enter a home or its cartilage in order to search a vehicle therein. And so if this court disagrees with the state and say Collins, and says Collins does apply, I think that's the end of their argument at that point. If this court agrees with the state and says that Collins does not apply, Mr. McCrary mentioned it, I do raise the issue of whether the automobile exception would even have been met in this case. Because if you read the case law on that, there are, what the cases say as far as when the exception applies is that when the vehicle is mobile and you have probable cause to believe that it contains contraband or evidence of a crime, and if the car is readily mobile, comes from Pennsylvania, LeBron, in Maryland v. Dyson, these are all Supreme Court cases, they say readily mobile means operational or readily capable of being used on the highways. This car could start, as Mr. McCrary said, he moved it up, but it was not readily capable of being used on the highways. It had two cars behind it. It couldn't have even gotten out without making those cars leave. And further, by the time that this search happened, by the time they videoed, they go back into the cartilage, video where they see the gun, there are three or four or five officers, I don't remember. By the time they do all that, and then they take the little tool to actually break into the car, Mr. Cerna's already on his way or at the jail. He's not even on the property anymore. This car is not readily mobile at any point, much less the time that they broke into it. And so I'm not sure that they even meet that exception, even if Collins doesn't apply.
Ms. Schoen, what about Mr. McCrary's point about exceptions to the warrant requirement when I guess executing an arrest for a parolee or a felon, you know, are they entitled to
be honest with you, Justice Kelly, I didn't prepare anything on that because that was not raised in the trial court. That was not something that Judge Waldrop ruled on. It's not law applicable to the case for that reason. There was information that they knew he was a felon before they ever went to the property. But as far as having less, you know, privacy protections because of that, I did not prepare for that because it wasn't raised at the trial court.
And stepping back to, is it your position that Judge Waldrop made a finding that this was Cerna's residence?
Yes. Yes. And if you look at my brief, I did point out, it's almost like the state speaking out both sides of their mouth. With an arrest warrant, you can go to a person's residence if you believe they're there. Well, is this his residence or not? They treated it that way because they went to the address that was given by the officer that requested the help. They confirmed the address with his parole officer. They were told by another officer, if that car, that certain car is there, he's there. They went into his room. In the video, he's rummaging through his room. You can see the personal belongings he has there. There is no question that that's his residence. And as far as what the mother-in-law said, she said, yes, my daughter and he live here. And so she confirmed that. So yes, it was his residence. That's how they treated it, especially in this case with going with the warrant. I did want to address one thing Mr. McCrary brought up with, he said there was a case that says if you have an arrest warrant, you can even go into the back and look into the windows and sheds and those kind of things. The case he's referring to is called Moorhead. I believe it's the Court of Criminal Appeals case. And in that case, they had reason to believe that the potential arrestee was on the property. And so they're looking for him. So of course they can walk around the property looking for him. Interesting in that case, When they looked in the shed through the window, they saw what they believed were marijuana plants growing. What did they do? They went and got a warrant so that they could go back and seize those marijuana plants. It's the same issue that we have here. And so it doesn't allow you extra authority to go into the property.
Ms. Schoen, assume, as the state does, that curtilage privacy interests can be decoupled from those in the adjoining home. What facts here support Cerna's privacy interest just in the curtilage as opposed to the home just generally?
I think that that comes down to the fact that it's his actual residence. He's living there. There is no evidence, I don't believe, in the record that says he can't access the garage or he has no privacy interest in the garage or that's mine, not his. And the car that he was moving up that he said that his wife owned was within that carport. And so he's clearly utilizing that for their personal access, personal possessions. And I think if you're a resident of the home, unless you know of some limit, you have to believe that they do have that privacy interest in the curtilage because it goes along with the home. It's supposed to be treated the same as the home. So if you saw a gun in a locked case in the home, knew he was a felon, brought him out to the street, I don't think the officers would believe they could go back in the home and break in that cabinet. I think that is the same thing that we're talking about here. I'm sorry. And so, let's see. Back to the, I think I covered the plain view argument. The automobile, I don't believe applies, but even if it does, Collins would overrule that argument right off the bat. The officers, like I said, there were four or five of them, and there wasn't just the one that went back. All of them were going back and forth from the end of the driveway, past two cars, into the carport, doing what they needed to do, ultimately breaking in the car. And so to go back to what I said earlier, I do believe that there was a second entry into that carport, which required a warrant or some exception to the warrant requirement, which the state has not provided. And unless there are any questions, that's all I have.
Okay.
I'll give some time back. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the podium will be sanitized before you start. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to point out a couple of things real quick. First of all, as to Collins, one of the key things with Collins is that in that state, the government conceded standing. Standing was never addressed, and I think that is a key distinction in this case because I think there's major issues as to standing starting out. As to the comments that counsel made about the issue of his parolee status not being before Judge Waldrop, the way that's been analyzed and that expectation of privacy as part of standing. So standing is always subject to being reviewed on appeal, as I pointed out in the state's brief. And so that's an element of the standing in this case, and that's why it's properly before this court. I'll also address the automobile exception just briefly. It's very clear that the mobility in the sense means it's operational. So there's some case law when there's a car up on blocks that obviously can't be moved, it doesn't have a motor in it, that it really isn't much of an automobile. But the Supreme Court has ruled, I believe, in Texas v. White, it's a really old case. There's cases where a car is in a police impound yard. It has been seized and impounded and locked in one of our storage facilities with razor wire around it, and you don't need anything but probable cause to go out there and search that car. So as the mobility in that sense, whether it can be moved on the highway right at the moment, as long as it's an operational vehicle and you have probable cause, you can search it. So,
do you disagree with Ms. Schoen's contention that There are two cars behind it. It's at the end of the carport. I mean, to get out of it, it'd either have to drive through the beams of the carport or knock into the cars in the back to leave the driveway.
No, there's no way I could disagree with that. It's clearly on the video. I mean, there's two cars. In fact, is one of the cars is the one I was describing earlier. Mr. Serna leans on some during the video. She notes that there's some distance there. There's distance for two cars to be parked. His car is right by the door. The one, and I say his car, it's actually not his car, according to him repeatedly. It's the dog.
Right.
But it's right there. You have to squeeze between it and the wall to get to the stairs up to that door right there. So it's right there. Then there's two other vehicles that occupy distance down that driveway. The last one's right at the edge of the sidewalk, and that's where they're leaning around waiting on the mother-in-law to reappear. One of the interesting aspects of this case is that at the time that we go back up and seize this gun, the homeowner has arrived. And to cite the Court of Criminal Appeals in Granados, they stated that guests who stay indefinitely have a reasonable expectation of privacy, but that expectation is controlled by the owner of the property. And I think that's some of where the issue comes in this case, is certainly any expectation he has is limited to what the homeowner allows. And looking at the record, what is indisputable is at 15 minutes in the video, he specifically says, "It's my mother-in-law's house." That's the defendant's words. Later on, when she arrives, 2210 in the video, she states, "This is my house." He only stays in that room. Mm-hmm. It is very clear that he has a right to occupy one room in that house and one room only. And that's made clear by both parties, and that you have any kind of words in that realm. Beyond that, at the time that the officers go up and seize that out of the gun, the mother-in-law is actually helping them. But she is participating in this. She actually goes and gets a key for them.
Well, she, and we've all seen the video, all the members of the court here, she says, "Oh, let me go find one," but the key doesn't work. So is it,
she's trying.
There's an argument. Is that helping or not helping to find a key that maybe she knows doesn't open the vehicle or maybe does open the vehicle?
Well, beyond that, she tells them, "Hey, y'all do what you need. I got to go. When you get done, give whatever you need to. My daughter's right here in the house." At that point, it seems that she's pretty comfortable in acquiescing as the homeowner to the officers being on her property. In fact, is leaves them on her property and just tells them, "Hey, here's the door. Let my daughter know when you get done."
Is it your position then that the mother-in-law said, "You can search all the curtilage, you can search whatever you want, I'm leaving," that she gave them permission to search anything they wanted on the curtilage?
She seems to have consented to their presence on her property.
After they've told her they're going to not bust into the car one way or the other?
They tell her, they ask some questions about the gun, and they tell them that they're going to get the gun one way or the other, yes.
Was that before the trial court?
It's on the video. Most everything in this case, that's what makes this case very unique, is that everything is on the video pretty much. There's a very good body camera and you can see the entire events. It's just how you apply a lot of complex law and, quite frankly, very fact-specific law. When you start looking at all these cases, there's all these different factors, and this case has a lot, I see my time's up, of factors that don't exist in Collins. The tarp not existing is a major factor. The standing issue is a major factor. The parole status is a major factor. All of those things need to be considered, and I believe those all distinguish this case from Collins, and it's not controlling in this situation. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted. The court will be in recess.